Alex Spinell's in the studio with some breaking history news. He has updates. What, you have two stories?
I do. There's so much history going on, Dave, that I have to do two stories a week now. I'm running rag. I'm working like 80 hours a week to get this job done. You know.
I can imagine. So you've got one about the fate of the historic gazebo at Clark Park in Everett, and the other one is the hostile hacking of the Facebook history group Seattle Vintage.
Yes, and we'll do them separately so it's not too confusing. Now, Dateline Everett, the Everett Historical Commission convened last night at Everett City Hall. You might remember they met last month to weigh a request from the Everett Parks Department to demolish the 1921 Clark Park gazebo, part of a plan to build an off-leash dog area and to get rid of the structure because they say it attracts crime. Now, Clark Park is in North Everett, not far from Everett High School, officially in the Bayside neighborhood. Some neighbors agree and they want to get rid of the gazebo because they say it does attract crime. Others think it's worth preserving as one of the most historic publicly owned buildings in Everett. And one commissioner said that particularly because the gazebo was owned by the city needs to set a better example in caring for and preserving it. Now, Bob Leonard is parks director in Everett. He made it clear why he wants to tear it down.
We're not looking to remove the gazebo because of the dog park or because of the condition it's in. The gazebo is looking to be removed because the gazebo is an issue unto itself. It is an attractive nuisance. It's not going to solve all the problems if it goes away, but it does create problems.
Now, at the last meeting, commissioners had asked for some specific information from the Parks Department about alternatives to demolition, but the parks didn't provide that info last night. What commissioners had been looking for was middle ground. Chair Patrick Hall said last month, essentially, you know, if tearing down the gazebo isn't a silver bullet, if it doesn't completely get rid of all the crime, build the dog park, keep the gazebo for now, and see if all that new activity means the crime goes away, and so then we don't have to tear it down. Seems perfectly reasonable to me. This is Parks Director Bob Leonard again making it clear how he feels about that compromise. We also hear a little bit from Patrick Hall in this cut.
Can I just speak to that?
Yeah, I don't think we need a motion on that.
Sure. I can say that I will check on that. One of the reasons we don't have that now is I just don't feel that we are supportive of that model happening. So I don't know that we want to present something that is not going to be supported by the city or the staff. So I'm just trying to be transparent about that.
So there's no interest on the city side in this compromise that the commission was proposing. Now, ultimately, last night, a decision on the demolition request was postponed on a procedural question. The historical commission took a formal vote to ask the city attorney for an opinion. So tune in again in April for the third episode of As the Gazebo Turns. Now, in our next update, you might remember we reported 2 weeks ago that the popular local history Facebook group Seattle Vintage, which has more than 150,000 followers, had been hacked and taken over by malicious actors. I do now have some good news to share. Now, quick recap. By impersonating members of this Facebook group with what they call administrative privileges, people who can, you know, approve of posts and things, the hackers were able to take over and kick everyone out, all in preparation for some kind of nefarious activity, selling it to somebody or doing something weird, right? Now, the scary part of this is there's no remedy available, no way to report it to Facebook. The FBI couldn't do anything. Attorney General Bob Ferguson's office had nothing to say other than some form you could fill out. Now, Erin McAllister O'Malley is one of the Seattle Vintage administrators. She told me that one of the Seattle Vintage Facebook followers, just some local person who loves the old photos and the stories, this person got in touch with her and offered to track down a real live human being at Meta, you know, Facebook's parent company, that this person knew, to get that person personally involved, reverse the hacking, and regain control. And that's exactly what happened last Tuesday, but only for a few minutes.
Suddenly, one day, an email from Facebook saying, "We have given you control again." However, I had control for about 3 minutes, and I removed a post from somebody who was not supposed to be there, and I was instantly blocked. Apparently, admins can be hidden. They can hide themselves, which none of us knew about.
So it's just crazy. And Erin was pretty upset.
And I threw my phone in a dramatic way on the counter, and I said, "God." And then I sent the screenshot of it being unavailable to my little group there. And
These people are very passionate about history.
I didn't know historians swore.
Oh, man. Boy, do you ever listen to me talking to Foley over here during the commercial breaks? Okay, so fortunately, through some crazy moves that would be time-consuming to explain, Erin and a core team of administrators regained control again last Wednesday, kicked out all the hidden administrators. It was like when the Allies liberated Paris, you know, and there were Nazi snipers. It was kind of like that sort of scene. They kicked everybody out.
I didn't realize, so if your Facebook page is hijacked, there is nobody at Facebook who will help you?
Well, if you have a friend you can reach out to, that's one of the big takeaways. Yeah. So we know that none of these problems existed 20 years ago. Like when I worked at Mohai, if people wanted to share stories, they had to come in person or mail me a photograph
exactly.
of them.
Exactly.
Now, we know that social media is responsible for, or at least complicit in, a lot of bad things, right? We hear about that every day. But as I've said before, I think local history, more than anything else, benefits in incredible ways from people of all walks of life being able to share their photos and vintage documents and memories with each other on a platform like Facebook. I don't think any other sector benefits from social media the way local history does. Kind of a crackpot theory I have, but I think it's true. Now, Erin McAllister O'Malley agrees, and she knows why it's true.
Because everybody's walking around with their own history. Everybody's walking around with their own pieces of the thread that tie us together in ways that we didn't imagine in the old days because it took longer to get those threads together. Social media allows those threads to be woven together in a platform. It's in your pocket. If you move to another country, you can have Seattle with you because all these other people have those pieces together in one spot.
So if Facebook wants to start sponsoring these spots, I think, I can't talk about that. Anyway, so the news you can use part of this is that it's got to be really careful about managing a page like Seattle Vintage because people impersonate members of the group and then ask to have their administrative privileges restored. Very complex, but also very common. The other big takeaway is what you mentioned a moment ago. Facebook needs to do something to make it easier for groups to get help when there's trouble like this. There's no way to report this. You can report the person's profile who's actually doing all the stealing, mm-hmm. but if their profile doesn't have anything bad on it, they're approved. They're vetted by Facebook and everything's okay. If this person hadn't stepped forward, there would have been no sustainable or scalable. There is no sustainable or scalable model to address this kind of issue for 150,000 customers of Facebook. It's crazy.
Yeah, I really don't get that. Facebook occupies like huge amounts of office space. There's got to be someone you can call.
Unless you know somebody, there's not. That's the part that's just totally. And these actors who had hacked this thing. One of the people we talked to last week, Doug Palmer, a member of the group, he was able to track that they'd done this to a bunch of other pages. They stole all these other websites and domains, and they were sort of, it was a...
And to what end? Were they making money on it somehow? Or?
I think they steal a site, with 150,000 followers. Yeah. They run it for a while as kind of like a dummy or a clone or something, and then they sell it to somebody else who then starts putting ads on it. So if you're used to seeing pictures of, Frederick and Nelson Santa Claus, all of a sudden here's the thing for some, really comfortable shoes that I walked in, and it's like the equivalent of one expensive social media post
But that hurts the reputation of those sponsors then, too, right?
No one cares about reputation anymore, Dave. It's just about selling stuff and doing stuff that doesn't require human intervention. And because Facebook would need an actual human to respond to this, the moves that they did to pull this off were so complicated. It was when they landed the on the moon with all these different mission controllers, taking one particular step at the right time to steal this thing away or get it back and have the people not steal it again. It's a crazy, scary world out there on the internet.
Felix Spinell, all his features at mynorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
It's almost here. Opening day for the Mariners is tomorrow, and Cairo News Radio's Paul Holden, our favorite Mariners superfan, can't wait.
The sun is shining, the days are longer, and the unofficial start of summer is tomorrow. Opening day. The Mariners begin yet another quest for the World Series, and to get ready for one of baseball's biggest days, I spoke with baseball writer and author of Why We Love Baseball, Joe Posnanski. I started with one simple question. Why do we love baseball?
It's really funny. I have a lot of answers to the question of why I love baseball, and obviously inevitably wrote a whole book about why we love baseball. But for me, I think it comes down to these moments that we all have with the game that stay with us. For me, that was growing up in Cleveland. It was playing catch with my dad. It was going to, watch Cleveland play at old Municipal Stadium and my heroes like Dwayne Kuiper and Buddy Bell and Rick Manning and these guys, just living and dying with everything that they did, playing Little League. I mean, it's all of these individual moments that I think make you fall in love with the game. And then all of these moments that come along constantly. I mean, the stuff that you guys very much understand in Seattle over the last little bit since Julio Rodriguez got there, that just reminds you why you love the game and sort of reinvigorate that love for baseball.
A moment that reminds me why I love baseball is I can remember exactly where I was when the Colorado Rockies made the World Series. The eruption of the crowd and the vibes of Colorado during the 2007 postseason run. A moment where the entire state was joined together, glued to the screen, hoping for the best for the Rockies. It's a moment that cemented my fandom for life. Opening day holds a special place in my heart as well, as it does with baseball fans, and I wanted to know, what makes it so special?
It's one of these sports that I think you renew every year. You know, it's this time of the year, it's opening day, and it's like, oh yeah, baseball, it's here again, and you fall in love with it all over again. It really, to me, does come down to these moments.
The moments Poznanski is mentioning are the 50 he put into his book, Why We Love Baseball. To narrow down all of baseball's biggest moments to just 50 seemed like a tall task.
All I wanted from these moments, every single one of them, was, is this why we love baseball? That was it. It wasn't how important the moment was, or how dramatic the moment was, or how surprising the moment was. I mean, those surprising, dramatic, awesome moments are in here for sure, but it was, why do we love baseball? So, you know, so that was the only question. So when you think about Edgar Martinez's double, is that why we love baseball? Absolutely. And particularly in Seattle.
And the 0-1 pitch on the way to Edgar Martinez. Swung on and lined down the left field line for a base hit. Here comes Joy. Here is Junior to third base. They're going to wave him in. The throw to the plate will be late. The Mariners are going to play for the American League Championship. I don't believe it. It just continues. My, oh, my.
Edgar Martinez's double wasn't the only Mariners moment that made the book.
Well, we love baseball because it's dramatic. We love baseball because it's poetic. We love baseball because it's funny. We love baseball because it's sweet. And to me, that moment, you know, I mean, you want a great Ken Griffey Jr. moment in there. And for me, there's you could watch his swing, and that could be the moment. Obviously, he had, you know, incredible home runs. Those could be the moments. But to me, the moment that he steps in front of his dad, they're playing together, stealing the fly ball, and just the great smile on his face after he did it, you know, and his dad looking at him the way that all of our dads probably have looked at us at one point or another. Just amazing, just wonderful. And to me, very much at the heart of why it is we love baseball.
As for the Mariners of today, a new season begins tomorrow, a new season full of promise and expectations, 162 games of opportunities to remind ourselves why we love baseball. Paul Holden, Cairo News Radio.
Let's get our military briefing now from CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland. I wanted to ask him about the recent terror attack on that Russian entertainment complex in Moscow, which has kind of dropped out of the headlines. And according to Jeff, the Russian government is now trying to figure out just how to spin this story.
They're trying to wrestle with what the narrative is. They're trying to wrestle with how they pin this on the Ukrainians. That seems Mr. Putin's effort. Clearly, he's embarrassed by this particular attack. There's been a number of large-scale terrorist attacks in Russia over the last 25 years or so. But this is pretty devastating, and 130-plus people being killed, a large number being injured. So it was claimed by ISIS-K, and in fact, the United States had warned the Russians on the 7th of March of the possibility of a large-scale attack. The Russians dismissed this, and all indications seem to be from intelligence now coming out from the U.S. and, frankly, some of our NATO allies that it was most likely ISIS-K. And the perpetrators who have been picked up all are from Tajikistan, from Central Asia. But there's this continuing effort by the Russians to change the narrative. Well, there was a window. They were going to Ukraine. But none of the evidence seems to be pointing in that direction. But I think they're going to continue to try to do that as they try to bolster support for the war within the Russian Federation.
Now, this was an organized attack on this entertainment complex. And it's not the first time there's been an attack on a theater in Russia. I seem to recall something similar where they had to use knockout gas to get the terrorists out. Were they not prepared for such a thing?
Well, it does appear that's the case, and you're right. There was a large-scale attack on a theater, and they used gas to try to render the terrorist attackers and neutralize them. But in fact, many believe that, in fact, killed a number of the people who were being held there. There have been about four or five over the last 25 years ago, most in and around Moscow. Some point back to 1999, in fact, when there were several bombings in Moscow. Putin was just coming to power as the prime minister, and many believe these were false flag attacks perpetrated by the FSB and by Putin to galvanize support for the war in Chechnya. They blamed it on the Chechens, and of course then Russia conducted a devastating war in Chechnya. This all goes back to really the animosity between the Muslim world and Muslim extreme groups and Russian Federation, which dates all the way back to 1979 with the invasion of Afghanistan by Russia, and then the Soviet Union, subsequently Russia. And then, of course, the Chechen War, which was devastating, largely a Muslim population in the Southern Caucasus. And then, of course, Russian intervention in Syria, in which Russia has been on the side of Bashar al-Assad, who has definitely an enemy of groups like ISIS-K and ISIS-Khorasan. So these have all, I think, encouraged ISIS-K and groups like this to strike out at the Russians. And, of course, we've seen them do that with devastating effects elsewhere. It was ISIS-K that conducted the attack at the Abbey Gate that killed 13 Americans in Kabul as we were withdrawing. It was ISIS-K that conducted a large-scale terrorist attack in Iran only a couple months ago and killed hundreds of people. So this is clearly a good bit of history to this, and I think ISIS-K demonstrating its animosity towards the Russian leadership, trying to establish its brand, recruit new fighters, gain support worldwide.
CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland. And the next conflict I wanted to get his comment on was, of course, the conflict in Gaza, where a significant rift has now developed between the U.S. and Israel.
There's clearly glowing strains between the United States and Israel that are almost unprecedented. I mean, think about it. We've had the leading Jewish politician in the United States, the majority leader Chuck Schumer, give a speech on the floor of the United States Congress calling for elections in Israel to depose Prime Minister Netanyahu. And then we just had a vote in the United Nations calling for immediate permanent ceasefire in the war in Gaza. The United States had vetoed three other efforts to pass such resolutions because of its support for Israel. But this time, the Biden administration decided to abstain, and that particular Security Council resolution was, in fact, passed. This seemed to anger Mr. Netanyahu so much that a delegation of Israelis leaders were supposedly coming to Washington at the Biden administration's invitation to discuss alternatives for the pending offensive against Rafah. We've got about 1.3 million people crammed into that small city, and now they have, in fact, canceled all that. So that animosity, that strain is certainly growing. As we also await any action by the United States Congress on a military aid package for both Ukraine and for Israel, which is curious because it's held up in many ways because very extreme right-wing Republicans on the right oppose military aid for Ukraine, and very extreme left-wing Democrats on the left oppose additional aid for Israel, which has caused this bill, I think, to be in an impasse, at least for the moment.
Yeah, we keep hearing the Biden administration implying that there are better ways to win this war against Hamas. Do you have any idea what they're talking about, what a better tactic would be?
Well, the better tactic I think they're talking about is more targeted efforts to try to destroy the leadership of Hamas, as opposed to a whole-scale heavy armor offensive with artillery and airstrikes into the city with 1.3 million people crammed into it. They would continually point out to Israel that in terms of winning the war, it's the long-term solution and long-term stability that really you seek. And now that there are over 32,000 Palestinians have been killed, 75,000 Palestinians have been injured, Israel is probably as isolated on the global community as it's ever been in its history. And again, an offensive like that will just continue to isolate Israel into the future. And then the last piece of that, of course, is this urging Israel to seek a political partner to, in fact, negotiate with about the future of the Gaza Strip. For the United States, that would be a renovated Palestinian Authority, which moves you, though, in a direction of a two-state solution, which is not where Mr. Netanyahu wants to go. Because at the moment, even if they were successful in this military operation in Rafah, sadly with large-scale civilian casualties, they would be faced then with the occupation of the Gaza Strip with their military forces for an indefinite period of time. We used to say it was 5 to 20 soldiers per 1,000 to control the population. Well, you do the math for the Gaza Strip with about 2 million people, and you can get to a sizable military force that's doing nothing but occupation duty indefinitely.
CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
Take care, Dave.
And still no progress reported this morning on the attempt to proclaim a ceasefire in Gaza.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Firefighters in Billings, Montana went above and beyond the call of duty for one of their residents they serve. It wasn't long ago that Roger Labrie worried every time he left his house. He was born with cerebral palsy, and when he opened his front door, he often stared down at an old and deteriorating ramp. His fiance says that he fell and she couldn't get him up, so they were forced to call the Billings Fire Department. Firefighter Shane Perry helped with the call and couldn't help but think it was only a matter of time before he would slip again.
Something needs to be done about this because Roger was falling. That wasn't the first time he had fallen, I guess.
So a few days later, after that call, he went back to his house and built him a new ramp, ensuring he would never fall again. In just a couple of days, Perry and other friends rebuilt that old ramp with a longer, wider, and sturdier passageway for Labrie, and he could safely get in and out of his home now, making it possible for Roger's steps to become a bit more confident.
My son Leo was saying to me, "Wow, you go up the ramp a lot faster." And I said, "Yeah, it's a lot easier."
Yay for firefighters.
Yeah. Here's Ursula from the Gian Ursula Show. Good morning.
Good morning.
You want to talk about this unusual football drill that was conducted by this coach in Shelton? I'd actually heard of this idea that as a way to reduce concussions, you would do tackling drills without any kind of pads.
Because yes.
Supposedly, you know, you would then hold back.
Exactly. Yeah. In this case, they were doing these tackling drills during a PE class. And so the Shelton High School head football coach, his name is Mark Smith, and he's now resigned. I'm actually going to bring Sully into this conversation because as a football mom, so both my boys played football. I would be dismayed by some of the tackle drills that my sons would tell me about after the fact. And in the case of these kids, this looked very similar to what my boys would tell me would be called bull in the ring.
Bull in the ring?
Okay.
No.
Sully?
The video I saw didn't show anything remotely like this.
Okay.
Like bull in the ring is basically where you surround one player in like about a 4-yard circle and the coach points to the person who just runs and tries to knock the guy down. A lot of times the person is coming from behind and your idea is to turn really quick and take on the block. Don't do that anymore. That's a no-no. That's something you don't do. This was more
okay,
like...
Okay, now that was done though. When my kids were in football, I mean...
Right,
that,
but
that's,
I mean, that's
it,
what I mean.
The
over
last...
the last... 15 yes. years, they've made that change. You don't do that. That's nothing you do in youth football. And if your youth football coach is doing that, and even at the high school level, find another program.
Exactly.
That's not good.
Exactly.
What I saw in the thing here was like kids in basically kind of like one guy running and another guy running.
They're
and
running
he would juke the guy.
What's
and
juke they, mean?
That would mean... You do the
try
little shit, you avoid the tackle,
the
and
way.
Then they would, you know, kind of hit each other. It didn't, to me, it didn't look terrible. It wasn't
okay,
like they
me,
were going full
look...
on head to head.
Well,
I mean, but then again, I grew up in an era when we did more at recess than this was bad. But
and I
again,
think
that's my opinion.
Lies the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because for these kids in this particular incident, the parents are saying that at least 5 kids were injured in a span of 30 minutes. One kid's head, I mean, one of the students was telling Cairo 7, you know, one of the kids had their head slammed into the wall. Another kid got a dislocated finger. And I know that there is a tendency, and again, just in my years of being a football mom, there's a tendency like, oh, that's part of the sport. It's a very violent sport. But
At
you
got
to do something to try to minimize when you're not actually in the game of a very violent sport already. I mean, this seems like an unnecessary situation where he was putting kids at risk. And now,
and that wasn't the actual PE class either. He was filling in during
a weightlifting class
and decided to run tackle drills without pads.
Exactly.
Probably because a lot of the kids in that weightlifting class were probably on his
football team.
That's how weightlifting classes usually are
exactly.
in high school.
So now,
if they were going to do, just really quick, if they were going to do something in this situation, I would have had them do what we did when we had no pads on, would be like a 3-yard slow walk hot tackle where you go and you mimic the motion. You go and you hit the person around the waist at no impact and just kind of roll them over.
That's not what we saw.
That's not what was happening
no.
here. So I don't want to minimize that. But that was something he could have done that would have definitely minimized.
So I'm curious, what's the mentality here? Are there some coaches that feel they have to man up their kids?
There are still coaches who think that.
Yeah, that's kind of the archaic way of doing it. The way I was brought up, the way I started coaching, but then I learned and did things differently. Yeah, I mean it's. There's no need to do it like this.
Yes.
My question for you, Ursula, is, you know, and I heard from the parents, I listened to the entire story from Jake Chapman at Cairo 7 TV. Not only do they want him fired instead of resigned, they want the assistant coach fired. They're filing a lawsuit to make sure. I feel like it's going a little too far. Does everything have to be litigious? or is resigning and the school saying, we will do better, this will never happen again, enough? Does there need to be a lawsuit?
You know, that's up to the individual person. I'll just ask you this. If your kid's got a concussion now or, you know, has had multiple concussions and this is the one that makes him sit out of sports for the rest of his life, would you want a lawsuit?
Well, is he sitting out on sports for the rest of his life?
I don't know, but that, yeah. But let me just give you a couple of details. 1 million young men play high school football in the U.S. each year. 67,000 a year are clinically diagnosed with a concussion. Most still go unreported or undetected. And you know this whole thing about CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy? A new study has diagnosed CTE in more than 40% of youth, high school and college athletes, primarily football players, who were exposed to repetitive head impacts from contact mm-hmm. sports and died before the age of 30.
Horrific.
Again, why put someone under unnecessary...
Won't this correct itself as parents stress. Realize they're not going to sacrifice their kids to a violent sport?
Well, that's a whole nother conversation, and I'll let you take that one out with Sully, whose son plays football for a college.
Chris Leroy team. Thanks, Ursula.
Thank you.
Right now, let's get another perspective on this week's bridge collapse in Baltimore. I remember how I felt when the old Mercer Island Bridge went down. It was like living in an apocalyptic movie. And Cairo Radio host Spike O'Neill grew up in Baltimore. The Francis Scott Key Bridge must have been a landmark for you. How did you feel when you saw the thing collapse?
Dave, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's really heartbreaking. I mean, you put it so well, but the floating bridge is something that's such a part of your childhood and your life. I was just traveling over that bridge last September when I went back to Maryland to visit family. And it's amazing how much that bridge means to the city, not just it's named after Francis Scott Key, the guy's art. He's bigger than Ripken in Baltimore, believe it or not. and the amount of commerce and freight and livelihood associated with that bridge. When you get to the north end of that bridge, what was once steel mills and shipping yards, now is Amazon distribution centers, FedEx distribution centers. 15,000 employees work in the port itself, with 150,000 people have ancillary incomes and livelihoods related to port activity, and that is all up in the air right now.
As you watch this play out, the investigation, the coverage spike, what information are you looking for?
It's funny because we have this rare, I hate to say the word gift in such a tragic situation, but the video of this incident happening with the ship losing power once, then restoring, then losing power again, and the ship actually was under full power, it seems, from the video that we've been able to see, when it hit the bridge. So we know a lot right there that we wouldn't know if we weren't in the age of recording everything. You know, it's hard to say where the investigation will take this story. I know that the black box, per se, for the boat has been recovered. So they'll have full details of what exactly took place during the incident and as it hit the bridge and lost power. But also the fact that the bridge, or the boat, I should say, sent a mayday out before, when it first lost power. That alerted the bridge operators, the employees, and the Maryland State Patrol to slow and stop traffic across the bridge, which averted a much greater disaster.
Were there any protections, any pilings of any kind in front of the bridge that would, guide ships through the channel if they stray?
You know, Dave, there's things called, I think they're called dolphins. I'm not maritime savvy. And they're concrete, literally concrete bumpers around the footings of the bridge. And actually, this bridge was struck by a cargo ship in the early 80s, if my memory serves. But the boats now have grown in size and capacity to the point where I don't know that anything, this boat was loaded down with 100,000 tons of cargo, completely full, ready to leave port. Nothing would have stopped that bridge. So somebody asked me yesterday, would a pilot tug have helped? It's hard to say if it could have, when the boat loses power, it loses the ability to slow or steer. So would a tug nudging the boat away from the pylon or the support have averted this? It's possible, but I can't imagine it would have helped.
What's Baltimore like in these situations? The people, often we see people coming together in this and helping each other out. What's your thought on how Baltimore is reacting to this?
I've seen so many people have reached out to me, and I've reached out to so many people, so many friends. Baltimore's a city of great, I don't mean to get all puffy, but it's a really proud city. It's a blue-collar town. We've never been Philly, we've never been D.C. You know, we've always had an inferiority complex. And of late, Baltimore's image has really been just, I mean, taken a massive hit with the horrible things said about Baltimore, with the reputation it's earned through neglect and mismanagement and everything else. But Baltimore's port is the largest port in America for vehicles, new vehicles coming in, wow, cars and small trucks and things like that. I mean, 850,000 vehicles came in last year alone. It's an economic engine. And I think this will actually give Baltimore a chance to realize who it is again, remember who it is, and how important that port is. It might actually be a good thing. I mean, the Key Bridge is iconic. It's a part of imagine seeing the Seattle landscape and the West Seattle Bridge is gone, or some major iconic image of our skyline is gone now. So Baltimore's scrappy. President Biden says they won't wait for any kind of settlements or investigations of who's to blame. The federal government will step in. We'll open the port. We'll rebuild the bridge with zero haste. I think that's a wonderful thing to hear, and that's going to help Baltimore recover from this. But it's the daily impact is unfathomable.
Car News Radio's Spike O'Neill from the Jack and Bikes Spike Show. Thank you, Spike.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you, Dave. Thanks, Colleen.
How about a Seattle apartment for $900 a month?
Yeah.
Yes, it's possible. It's not big. It's 180 square feet. But, you know, we used to call them
what?
Dormitories. You know, I lived in one for like 4 years. Here's 100? Mickey Gomez.
Yeah, micro apartments.
What was that square footage?
It was about 800 square feet, maybe?
No,
180. I'm sorry, 180. I apologize. 180 square foot room. Yeah.
The smallest I lived in was 425.
Yes.
And that was small.
Yeah. When I lived in New York City, I lived in a 400 square foot apartment inside a mansion.
Wow.
Because that's kind of what they did. They turned these old homes into apartments. And so all four of us lived in it.
Four people lived.
Yes.
Okay. Me, I just lived with my
Andrea,
cat.
My two kids. We had a dog and two cats. Oh. And we had a big patio outside. Oh. And it was easy to clean. Mm-hmm. The bedrooms were nice and big.
So it was okay.
Yeah, it was okay. We could.
Why haven't we done
do
this before? I mean, I remember when the homeless thing first started and they talked about it. Mm-hmm. I thought, perfect idea. Dormitories. We lived in these little rooms.
Yeah.
We had a bedroom, but we shared bathrooms. And did you guys share bathrooms at college, right?
Oh, yeah. No? I didn't live in a dorm, but yeah,
see,
that was common.
You didn't live in it. Well,
I didn't.
When I saw my kids' dorms, what they called dorms were apartments to me. I mean, they had their own bathrooms.
Right.
Our dorm was, you had one bathroom per floor. And of course, we were separated, men and women. Different, but you know, pretty, they integrated and people share the same bathrooms. Didn't matter. You had one bathroom on the floor, and that was it. And your only privacy was in that little room. Mm-hmm. The rest were all public spaces.
Yeah. I had to have my own private bathroom.
Yeah,
it was just. But there are.
But it's better to have a roof over your head than no. You know,
exactly.
This is very true. So, 180 square foot room, you can fit an air mattress or a small bed. They come with tiny fridge, stove. There's room for a small table. It's quite tight. But there are families of four or five living in these micro apartments because rent is absolutely unaffordable. These micro apartments, they call them SROs, single room occupancy. They were really popular about 10 years ago with construction workers and people who came here to live temporarily. But now they're becoming more popular, especially since Governor Inslee signed a bill that's going to require residential buildings to have at least 6 micro apartments. And that is supposed to take place late next year. Now, there are some of these micro apartments or SROs, single room occupancies, that come with private bathrooms, or there are some where you can share the bathrooms.
The problem is families. I think that's the cohort that's missing from these solutions. This is good for single people who are in individual tents on the street or something. But when you have family, three kids, a micro apartment's not going to cut it.
Or just couples getting their start. I feel like those apartments can work
it's
for couples.
Probably not, and you're right. But what are families going to do? I mean, there are more than 3,800 unhoused families with children in the Seattle area, and that's according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. So where are they going to go?
Yeah.
Especially if they don't have family or they are here and they've got jobs here. You got to make it work.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's where you do subsidized housing.
Well, I mean, even this is true. Some of these micros are not subsidized. So it's not like you have to qualify to get into these,
yeah,
but some of them are subsidized.
I was just reading an article out of Paris that that's how they've kept the middle class in the heart of the city, right, is most of the housing in the center of Paris, and Paris is huge, mm-hmm, is government subsidized. They just went, mm-hmm, no, we want a diverse core of people in Paris, so we're going to subsidize this, so and Seattle needs to start doing it.
And it's cheaper than cleaning up the aftermath of unhoused,
absolutely,
people.
And what's, absolutely, really interesting is that I did grow up in Europe. We lived in Germany for a very, mm-hmm, long time, and I remember when we went there and we walked in and I expected to see this glorious living room and a big kitchen. And no, we walked into our housing. You know, we had the two bedrooms. And then I went, well, where's the kitchen? They have tiny kitchens.
Mm-hmm. Everything's small.
All of, yeah, them. Everything was small, even the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And then we got used to that. And then we came back to the United States. And I remember walking in there. I'm like, this kitchen is huge.
Well,
we can
move
in
from
here.
Texas. Everything's bigger in Texas.
Well, yes, it's very, very true. Even the bugs.
Mickey Gomez. Thank you, Mickey. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.